The plan here is that what I'd like to do is give like a very brief overview of what's going on in the two parts of GiveWell's research process right now, the traditional research that focuses on international aid charities, and then the newer part that we're calling GiveWell Labs. And I want to do each of those, take about 5 to 10 minutes to give a very brief overview of what literally we're doing right now, and then let you ask questions. And kind of feel free to ask anything. Don't feel like you need to, you know, have followed GiveWell extremely closely to make sure that your question is like, you know, you're able to bring it up. And then, you know, I'm happy to stick around at the end and answer any other questions that people have one-on-one. So on the GiveWell traditional side, which I'll start with, you know, so that's the part of GiveWell that focuses on what we've called evidence-backed, you know, thoroughly vetted charities that serve the global poor. And these are organizations that are kind of on the more quantifiable end of the charitable giving spectrum. Even so, there's a lot of things that can go wrong when you're trying to give to those types of organizations. And I think that's a lot of what we've found over the last few years, is that it's very difficult to even give well when you're trying to give to those types of organizations. You know, last year, in 2013, and we tend to work on an annual cycle because people give so much at the end of the calendar year, we kind of expected that the year would play out very simply, and our top charities at the beginning of the year would end up being the same ones as at the end of the year. And there were major developments with all of our organizations that caused us to shift around the rankings. So some of you may know, like, AMF was one of our top charities. It was no longer at the end of the year. One of the big differences going forward in 2014 is that we had a very successful hiring last year. And so we brought on more people who I think will be able to contribute to this traditional work of ours. And that means that our plans for this year are more aggressive than they were last year. And so we're looking for new top charities in a variety of different causes. And I just want to like quickly go through some of the places we're looking for new top charities. So one cause is the cause of salt iodization. The idea is to fortify salt with iodine. This is an activity that has pretty strong evidence of effectiveness. For people who are severely iodine deficient, when they get adequate levels of iodine, it prevents significant cognitive and mental developmental disabilities, something that's called cretinism. Another manifestation of low iodine is goiter, where you have this like giant enlargement of the thyroid. And then finally, even among people who have more moderate levels of iodine deficiency, there are effects on IQ when people receive sufficient quantities of iodine. And so this, they're able to fortify salt with iodine. People pretty much all take in the same amount of salt, at least in developing countries, I imagine here too, since our salt is often iodized. And you know, this is a program that was successfully rolled out across much of the globe in the 80s and 90s, but as far as we've been able to determine so far, not fully complete. And so there are still large countries without donor focus that don't have their salt sufficiently iodized. And there are a couple of organizations that we're looking at who work in this area. One of them, their acronym is ICCIDD. I think that stands for the International Council for the Control of Iodine Deficiency Disorders. And so that's what they focus on. Now, they're not a direct service organization. When you do salt iodization, you don't like go around and iodize salt. Instead, you are advocating and providing technical assistance to governments, to policymakers to assist in these efforts. ICCIDD specifically is a network of academics, none of whom are really, only one of whom is full-time at ICCIDD, but they have people in all the different countries, they talk to them, and they're encouraging countries to iodize. Now, this is a very challenging type of effort to evaluate and determine whether or not they're effective, but our impression thus far, and it's all very preliminary, is that they have played a major role in a lot of the iodization efforts that have happened globally over the last 20 years, and they are seen as one of the main participants in iodization efforts. Like, they are pointed to by other entities, other organizations that work on this. Then another organization is the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. They run a wide variety of nutrition programs, so not just iodine. A major question that we'll have when working with them is whether one can direct funds to their iodization efforts opposed to you can always restrict your funds to iodization, but whether you can actually cause more effort to be put into iodization and more iodization to happen. This is something we've written a lot about in the past, this challenge, but we feel like we've reached a point in GiveWell's life cycle where we need to be trying to address this challenge of working with larger organizations and figuring out a way to meaningfully increase the amount of activity they do in some area, because many of the organizations that work on global health programs are large in nature. Unlike ICCIDD, GAIN is focused on more on sort of direct involvement in assisting governments in what they're doing. So where ICCIDD advocates at the sort of policy level or provides advice, GAIN is involved in, training the people on monitoring salt to ensure that it's been adequately iodized. So they kind of play different roles. But these are both organizations that we are, that we're looking at on iodization. We're also looking at another organization that focuses on neglected tropical diseases. SCI and Deworm the World, two of our current top charities, work on deworming. This is one set of neglected tropical diseases. Another one is called lymphatic filariasis. It's a little bit different. It has more direct harmful clinical or observable outcomes where people have their limbs kind of expand to very large size and it causes severe disability. And so there's an organization that in many ways is similar in form to SCI based out of another university. They focus on advocacy, technical assistance, and direct scale-up of lymphatic filariasis programs. They're called the Center for Neglected Tropical Diseases, or CNTD, but they focus on lymphatic filariasis. Again, this is at an early stage in our investigation. I think all three of those organizations plus AMF are like very plausible contenders to end up on the top charities list at the end of the year. I would be surprised if all four do, but I think all four like certainly could, and they're like, worth knowing about. The other area that we're looking into is immunizations. This is something we looked into in 2012, and we struggled to find places where it seemed that the main bottleneck was just like funding more vaccine activity or more distribution, as opposed to challenges of the logistics of reaching people in very far-flung places. And so it's been a couple years, and we felt like this was worth revisiting. And so we're looking at groups that work on tetanus immunization, the new meningitis A vaccine that the Gates Foundation developed, and the measles and rubella initiative. Finally, there's sort of a whole other area of our traditional focus, which is much more experimental. And this is trying to support the development of new top charities in the future. What we look for in top charities are organizations that are transparent, that are working on priority programs, and seem to be doing so in an effective manner. And so there was an organization called New Incentives that does conditional cash transfers. So where GiveDirectly, which you may know about, one of our top charities, just gives people $1,000 with no condition. New Incentives is giving out money to mothers in order to try and prevent the transmission of HIV. So when mothers come in, in the last trimester of pregnancy after they give birth, and then relatively early on, they take one of the antiretroviral therapy pills, which is what you would take if you're on AIDS treatment. Taking this prevents the transmission of HIV, and if they meet this condition, they get some amount of money from New Incentives. Now, New Incentives is very much a startup organization. They're not like, they would not qualify for a GiveWell top charity ranking right now, but because the program they do has a very strong evidence base, they're one that we're doing this experiment where we try and support them and help them get to the point where maybe in 3 years they're on the top charity list. And so to that end, Good Ventures, which is this foundation that we work closely with, made a $100,000 grant to New Incentives. We mentioned this in a blog post. We haven't written very much about New Incentives yet, but that it will come out shortly. And then on the other side of this question is not just the organization, but the evidence. And so we've also talked to groups like Evidence Action, Innovations for Poverty Action, which runs some of these randomized control trials, and ID Insight, which is a smaller group that does randomized control trials and other evaluations, but working more closely with nonprofits rather than working, with academics to create like academic level research. So all three of these groups are ones that we've talked to about potentially, we with Good Ventures like providing some funding to create additional evidence for possible future programs. And I'm happy to sort of talk about more specifics there if anyone's interested. So I guess I want to pause there and just take some questions on anything that I just said.
Yeah. The stuff like GAIN and ICCIDD is more like kind of advocacy-based, going to governments trying to tell them what to do or how they could be doing things. But it seems to me there's a lot more potential there to just run into a complete roadblock, right? Like you could be going to a government trying to advocate to them, and they just decide, no, we don't want this to do at all. And so then all the funding there has completely gone to waste, essentially.
Yep.
Whereas something like AMF, you know, it's like, okay, even if like half the nets are destroyed or distributed poorly or to people who don't need them, it's like, okay, you still have 50% or even 25% out. It's not a total loss. How are you trying to assess the risk of that and understand like the likelihood that these organizations are actually going to have any chance of succeeding, right? Because like just because they've done it successfully in three other countries before, it doesn't seem to be necessarily to bear on how successful they'll be in the future, because like any country could just be so different in a way that it's not for distributed. So,
like, yeah, I mean, I think this is like a really good question about advocacy organizations, which is there's just like it's much, much more difficult to assess whether or not they have been successful and will be successful. You know, we can look at the distribution that AMF did in Malawi. You can see like that they got the nets out. You can see how many nets are in use 2 years later because they monitor it. And I don't think we'll ever reach that level of understanding with ICCIDD. You know, we dealt with some of these issues. I think like SCI, which is one deworming organization we recommend, has some of these problems, in the sense that they provide some technical assistance. Deworm the World has them to an even greater extent because it is fully an advocacy technical assistance organization, and these are things we like try to write about explicitly in our reviews. And I think ICCIDD is like in some ways one level further down that path. So I think the things that we'll do are, you know, to the extent we can, vet the track record and try to understand what role they played and where, and as best we can understand whether or not, like, what would have happened in their absence. Though, honestly, I don't think we're going to get to an answer that is nearly as convincing as it would be about something like AMF. You know, then we'll try to do our best to understand where they intend to go and how that matches up with what they did in the past. And then finally, we'll follow them and see what happens. And I think we'll learn from that in particular. They're talking about countries, and I don't remember what of this we've published or not, but, you know, they're talking about countries like Angola or Madagascar. As far as we know, like, there's not much activity going on right now in these countries with iodine. The Gates Foundation made a big effort to fund many nutrition programs, but iodization specifically in high population countries like Nigeria, Ethiopia, India, and has left certain countries by the wayside. And so I don't think it'll be entirely impossible to have a better answer after the fact about the role they played. But I do think this is something that, you know, you or all donors need to think about when they're deciding where to give, that a donation to an ICCIDD-like entity or even now a Deworm the World-like entity is much more uncertain in some ways, in not only in terms of what happens, but in terms of how well you'll know after the fact what role your donation played. And the trade-off that you get with an advocacy organization is the possibility of significantly higher upside because, you know, they're a relatively small organization. Their budget is about $1 million a year. They think they can grow to about $2 million a year. And so with relatively small amounts of funding, you can potentially make a very big difference for an entire country. And, you know, these are things we'll try to quantify as best we can as part of our reviews, but we won't really ever know for sure.
I wonder what do you see as the bottleneck to your plan to cause there to be more nonprofits that structure themselves in a way that self-assessment's good, that transparency is good. Is it your guys' person hours? Is it like, you know, what's the bottleneck to like making more such organizations exist?
I mean, I think a big
to you like centralize that you if you for you causing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest challenge is, like, it's just difficult to start an organization that is, like, accomplishing good and like, running programs well. And so we have a very small set right now of organizations that we feel really good about. And I would I'm not optimistic that it will be easy for someone else. So the person who started New Incentives is a woman named Swetha. She's like moved to Nigeria. She's trying to get this thing going. And there's just a million ways in which she could fail to make this work. And I think, so I think that will be the key challenge for us, meaning finding people who are actually able to make this happen. And I should be clear, I mean, we're looking for, on the side of GiveWell that is our traditional research, we're looking for like a relatively specific thing. There's like a set of programs that have strong evidence behind them, and we're looking for organizations running those programs. We can do something to add to the body of evidence, but mostly what you need are people who can, you know, start organizations and try to implement these programs. And often what that means is interacting with, you know, larger institutions that are already in place in the country. So I think what happened with AMF is a good example of this. When AMF started, Rob Mather was distributing tens of thousands of dollars to individual NGOs all over the developing world based on their applying to him and him kind of doing a sanity check with his board on the quality of the application. As AMF grew, it got to a point where to move the amount of funding it had to negotiate with ministries of health and the other large donors like UK and US government that fund countries and these global health entities like UNICEF and the WHO. This was like a fundamentally different type of challenge. And it's something they obviously struggled a lot with over the last couple of years, though maybe they seem to be having more success now, which is really great. And so, you know, I think the main thing is like, we're not the ones who are going to create them. Like what we are here to do is like, first provide some support early on if people need, like, if we can provide some funding and some advice, but like largely it's going to have to be this like entrepreneurial activity where someone is able to like go on the ground and start something that works.
Do you have like documentation of which particular programs you're like actively looking for more people who?
So we have so it's a good question. There's a page on our website called like the priority programs page, which kind of lists the programs. In general, it's like basically the standard global, any type of like delivery of a global health product will be like probably priority. We haven't done like a full evaluation of many interventions. And so it's also possible, like if someone was like, I'm going to go out and start a pneumonia treatment organization, like I wouldn't even really know how, you know, what that would end up looking like.
Okay, so it's the kind of thing where like, if there were a sufficiently like transparent and like self-evaluative organization, you would like look at their intervention because the organization was good enough? Okay.
Yeah, and so one of the things that made in our research, we're always looking for two things, the evidence base and then the organization that is implementing it well, but is also like able and ready to be very open with us about what they're doing. And so that is like a difficult combination to find. So not to pick on them as you know, not to pick on UNICEF, but they're like very big and well known. So I'll just use them as an example. UNICEF runs health programs in lots of different countries. And there's a lot of challenges with evaluating UNICEF. But one primary one is it's just, they're so large that it's difficult to find the person who can communicate with you substantively about what their programs are doing in various places. And so therefore, like, they might be good. Frankly, we don't really know. I think there are, aside from the unknown, I think there's like reasons to give to like top charities as opposed to UNICEF. But nonetheless, like that challenge exists. And so we need organizations that are able to do that. And that kind of lack of transparency in a way that we can really understand what's going on is a major bottleneck for a lot of the organizations that we would potentially consider.
I just got an email like this morning or yesterday from AMF saying they've made some progress.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, there's a couple of things with AMF. One is that, you know, they did like finalize a net distribution in the Democratic Republic of the Congo for about 675,000 nets a few weeks ago. So that's about $2 million. I think that AMF had a total of $14 million in the bank at the time it finalized that distribution. So that meant that it still had $12 million in the bank. So for us, that was a great sign that like AMF has finalized a distribution in a place other than Malawi, which was the only place they'd ever done one of these very large scale distributions. They'd worked with a single partner there. So, you know, this was a really great sign and it's something we'll keep watching. I think the thing you got an email about, which I got an email about too, is they're also been negotiating like two other countries to try and finalize distributions. And I think after AMF's experience of the last couple of years where they felt they were very close to finalizing distributions in a few countries and then it fell through at the very end, they, you know, even though I think like Rob is optimistic that they'll finalize distributions, he's not ready to say that they're final. And I think that's appropriate given that they easily could fall apart at the last minute. So, you know, my guess is that like this distribution that people may have been emailed about is like one stage between the fully finalized and like optimistically, you're like cautiously optimistic. But I don't have like more details about this specific one. The thing I will say, which I think is an interesting sort of topic for consideration, is that if AMF finalizes this distribution, you know, then it will have like $4 million in the bank. And assuming that like the distribution meets the level of quality that other ones that it has agreed to has, and I certainly would guess that it will, because I think that's something AMF is pretty serious about. You know, at that point, like I think we would be seriously considering like putting them back on the top charities list because they had moved through the bulk of the funds they had in the bank. And more so, and you may have seen this in conversation notes we published from a conversation that I had with Rob recently. He's only negotiating with three distributions right now because the third distribution he's negotiating would go past the amount of funding they have. And so he's actively not building up a pipeline of potential distributions. And this obviously raises the question, like, is it appropriate to not be recommending them given that situation? I think, so in the short term, I think it's obviously I think it's the right thing to be doing because that's what we've decided, but I think it's worth thinking about because it certainly is making it harder for him to have a pipeline of potential distributions down the line that, like, we're saying, hey, like, we think it's right to hold off on giving to them for the moment. That said, so the thing we're really waiting for is the demonstration that AMF can consistently reach deals at a scale that is commensurate with the amount of funds they have. And that's not something they had been able to do as of 2 months ago. It's something they've shown some signs of and maybe now more signs of now. I do think longer term, like what I would guess happens with AMF is that if they successfully complete are like finalizing distributions at the scale of, you know, $10 to $15 million a year, like then what you would expect is to see them sitting on larger amounts of money over time, because that would just be the amount of lead time they would need in order to do their work. And, you know, last year was, I hope, a unique circumstance where they just hadn't yet built up that track record, and it seemed to make sense to hold money back rather than adding to that pile before they had successfully closed a deal that size.
What sort of events cause a deal to fail to be closed or distribution not to happen?
So just to sort of give one big giant caveat to this, like I had a lot of conversations with Rob at AMF, like people on AMF's board, other like people who were familiar with the specifics of their no negotiations in various countries. And we tried very hard to get permission to share as much of this as we could have. But this was a case where people were very sensitive about the specifics of what happened. The blog post that Holden wrote all about what happened with AMF does a like perfectly good job of like laying out our thoughts. But there's like a lot of detail that I don't think we're able to share publicly, which is too bad. I think the main two themes that, you know, so I think there's this big picture change, which is not an event. It was just like AMF was doing something that it had not done before. And when you do something new, it's just challenging and you like have some missteps. And so in this case, AMF was moving from, you know, first AMF from like 2004 to 2011 was giving out nets in chunks of like 25 to 50,000 or even less to like individual nonprofits scattered around sub-Saharan Africa. Then in 2011, they brought in more money. And this was not initially due to GiveWell. This was like another donor who gave them significant funds. And they felt that they could be more proactive in reaching deals. And so they had a partner, Consumer Universal in Malawi, that they felt very confident in. And they went to Malawi in concern and said, we can do a larger distribution, 250,000 nets, $1 million. After that, they got GiveWell's recommendation. And then very quickly, over the course of 2 years, moved up to having $14 million in the bank, like 10 plus of which came via GiveWell-directed donors. And at that scale, they were just negotiating, instead of with a single partner, with like different people, which, you know, we've talked a little bit about. And so I think that was new. And so then they ran into a couple challenges that they hadn't run into before. And so specifically, I think that their requests for monitoring and evaluation information were challenged more forcefully at the level of the Ministry of Health than they had been at this at a smaller scale or with a partner that they had a long track record with. And so I think that was one issue. A second issue was that, you know, they were hesitant to pay for non-net costs. I think this is a point where we have some degree of disagreement. Like, I have a disagreement with Rob. Like, I think it played more of a role. He doesn't think it played much of a role. He was much more involved in the negotiations than I was, obviously. So you should just know that we disagree on, like, the role that may have played. And then finally, I think as they had to communicate with different groups, types of groups and different levels of people, like, they just struggled to communicate well. Where I think, you know, and I'm not, anyhow, like, this is not something I have much more detail about, but like, that just caused problems where I think they thought deals were closer to being signed than they actually were. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I mean, I think those are like the highlights of what happened.
Can we get an update on what's going on with GiveWell Labs?
Yeah. All right. Segue. That's what we'll that's what we'll move on to next. So, GiveWell Labs is the sort of newer, more open-ended part of our research process. So where GiveWell's traditional work focus is very much on transparent charities that are working on programs with strong evidence bases, GiveWell Labs just says, like, what if we threw those criteria out the window and instead just tried to find the highest impact giving opportunities that we can, without focusing on evidence as a key input into what we're doing. A big difference between GiveWell Labs and GiveWell's traditional research is GiveWell's traditional research focuses on the charity, like, is there an organization we can recommend? And GiveWell Labs is focusing more on the cause level. Is this an area that can take in significantly more funding? And I think this makes a lot of sense because when you're a very large philanthropist of the type Good Ventures is, you can think about like a group like the Gates Foundation, you can create organizations or, you know, essentially put causes on the map in a way that they weren't before. And so therefore you don't want to hold yourself to just what currently exists. The sort of current focus that we have is by the end of the year having a few areas that we're ready to commit to for the next couple of years. And by commit to, we mean put significant full-time staff hours into them and, you know, probably make grants in the $5 to $10 million a year scale for a few years. And when I say all of this, we is like Good Ventures probably making the grant, with GiveWell being the research, sort of the research behind it. And a lot of the idea here is that we still would guess that the vast majority of the funding we influence is like in the future, like 5+ years from now. And so the next few years, we want to maximize the amount we learn about how to do this work well. And so we're trying to pick causes that we think are good and have sort of risen to the top in our work so far, but offer these really good learning opportunities. And then finally, you should just know as a kind of a disclaimer that, you know, I spend more of my time on the traditional side as opposed to the GiveWell Lab side. So there may be, if you have very specific questions, I may just not be able to answer them particularly well. So there's kind of like 4 big categories of causes we're looking at. Foreign aid, scientific research, global catastrophic risks, and policy. We've made the most progress on global catastrophic risks and policy, and the least on foreign aid and scientific research. By global catastrophic risks, I don't know how familiar this, I kind of guess most people are familiar with it, but just a very quick explainer is that it's like if something that has a very low probability of causing some very large impact, negative impact on humanity. So kind of a classic one people know about is an asteroid hitting the Earth and wiping out humanity. I think that one is probably not a great philanthropic cause, which I'm happy to go into, but that's the example of the type of thing that we're thinking about. And it's an area where I think philanthropy has, you know, it's particularly well suited to the cause because there's reasons that other actors are less likely to come in and play the role that they need to. So what I want to kind of go into is just our work on policy. But I'm happy to answer questions about the other ones, or if people are interested in the specifics about any of the things I mentioned, I'm happy to tell you where we stand. So we've spent a lot of the last year kind of looking into various U.S. policy causes and trying to get a sense of three basic questions. How important is it? Meaning, if we were to change it in the way that we hope, how much impact would that have in the world? How good is it? The second question is, how tractable is this area? Like, do you think it's likely that you could cause this change or not? And then finally, how crowded is the area? Crowded itself is a sort of difficult question to answer, because you'll often find causes with lots of government funding, but very little philanthropic funding. I think like biosafety as a possible global catastrophic risk is an example of that dynamic. Lots of government, very little philanthropy. You know, there are also causes where you may find crowdedness at one level and not at another. So immigration reform. There's a lot of activity around like current events and immigration reform in a very specific bill. But if you think about longer term loosening of immigration restrictions, particularly as an anti-poverty measure, meaning loosening or allowing immigrants from poor countries to move to richer countries, our impression is there's virtually no philanthropy there. So just to, you know, those are the big questions, and you know, there are these issues with answering these questions well. But if you go on our website on the, I guess it's like the givewell.org/shallow, there's a list of the various areas we've looked into and what we've done to try to answer these questions. You know, the cause we've probably done the most work on so far is criminal justice reform in the U.S. This is an issue that was highlighted to us when we started out by a few people who are kind of generalist policy advisors in philanthropy. So these are people like Stephen Tellis or Mark Schmidt. You may not know their names. There's conversation notes on our website from the talks we've had with them. And a lot of people pointed to criminal justice reform as an issue that was particularly tractable. And so it stood out on that characteristic, because, you know, many issues in U.S. policy are highly polarized between the left and the right. But criminal justice reform is something that had something of a transpartisan consensus, where the left is interested in it from a humanitarian perspective and the right is interested in it from a budgetary perspective. And so that allows for something to potentially happen in a way that it couldn't in many other areas. And so in this area, it's the first one where we've done what we call a semi-deep dive. We have all sorts of weird terminology for like how deep we go into an area, from shallow to semi-shallow to semi-deep deep dive. Anyhow, you can imagine. And so what that means is that we've done, you know, we've actually been out there looking for giving opportunities in criminal justice reform, with the notion that the better we understand what it looks like when you actually find giving opportunities, that can feed back into our broader process to know what we should be looking for at the higher level. And so what Good Ventures has done so far is funded an academic named Mark Kleiman. He's at UCLA. He is, you know, sort of someone we came into contact relatively early on, and has what I would call like unusually informative views about criminal justice reform. So to give an example of the types of things that, you know, he'll talk about is something called swift and certain sanctions. This is something where, you know, we have sort of taken an approach, I think, to criminal justice in the U.S. where we deter crime by having more severe sentences. And another approach might be to have swifter sentences that are shorter, because that may have a better deterrent effect. There was a study of this program. It did well in a randomized controlled trial. This is the type of idea he has. Some of what he's doing now is trying to study the effects of marijuana legalization in Colorado and Washington State. He had struggled to get funding, I think, from some of the other funders, and you know, so Good Ventures has provided some funding to him, and I'm happy to give a little more detail about his work if you want. Another person we funded is Angela Hawken. She's set up an organization called BetaGov, which aims to give state governments the tools to better evaluate their programs through randomized controlled trials. And then finally, we've been kind of talking at length with a large public charity that does more sort of direct advocacy at the state level, where they're trying to find like tweaks to state laws that can result in reducing the prison population. So that's sort of a major thing we've been working on, though. Not much of it is unfortunately not public yet. So criminal justice reform is this area. It stood out for sort of high tractability, where we felt like we could get involved, find opportunities, and then in a relatively short time period, see how they went. And so that's in process. Two other areas that we're interested in, and they're really on the other end of the spectrum. They're, I think, very low tractability, but very potentially high impact, and you know, very little philanthropy involved. One is labor mobility, which I mentioned earlier. So this is this idea of allow poor people to move to rich countries. This can have big effects as a great anti-poverty program. I mean, immigration is an incredibly controversial issue. This is not something that, if you would characterize criminal justice reform as like a downhill effort and change is happening, you would not characterize the type of immigration reform we're talking about as that. You know, nonetheless, I think it's certainly something that, you know, could be like one of the greatest anti-poverty changes that could take place. And so this is something that, you know, we also want to learn about. Like, what is the sort of long-term, low-likelihood effort look like? To date, all that we've done is Good Ventures made a grant to the Center for Global Development to support the work of Michael Clemens. He's sort of one of the biggest, if not the biggest, proponent of this, you know, this change. But, you know, this is something where I think we are, you know, going to do more work on this. It's plausibly an area we'll be involved in, but I don't yet know what involvement really means because it's a very different type of cause. And then the last cause that we're kind of thinking seriously about, and there's a lot that we're, you know, are sort of on the list in one way or another, but the sort of number three ranked one right now is basically macroeconomic policy or like recession management, for lack of a better term. You know, there are global recessions that just cause like huge financial losses in the developed world, but certainly have impacts in the developing world. And I think that, you know, I don't think we've had some conversations with, you know, leading economists, let's say, and no one really feels that we're handling these situations optimally. And if you could handle them better, you could potentially have a very large impact. Again, like this is like an incredibly challenging issue, and it's not clear what you would do. You know, maybe you could improve communication between like researchers and policymakers so that you don't, you know, you understand, maybe you can get people to agree that like you can spend more when you have a recession and it's not such a terrible thing. You know, alternatively, you know, maybe you just do better macroeconomic research in a way that's more like actionable, in a way that, you know, I think, I don't know how accurate this is. I think Paul Krugman wrote some op-eds in the aftermath of the 2008 recession, which said like we had to resort to Keynes's work of the 30s as opposed to like really relying on a lot of the work that had been done in the preceding 70 years. And so possibly this is like something that philanthropy can provide academic funding to, and that certainly is a natural fit for philanthropy. But again, you know, it's not entirely clear what getting involved in this area would look like. The main two things that stand out about both monetary policy and labor mobility are potentially very high impact and very little philanthropic involvement. And the next step would be doing more of a deep dive to understand what could actually be done. So I want to pause there. I'm happy to, you know, talk more about any of the four kind of larger categories: policy, foreign aid, scientific research, or catastrophic risks, or go deeper on policy and some of the other issues, or, you know, any other questions on labs or GiveWell that anyone has.
What kind of metrics would you be looking at to determine the impact for criminal justice reform? Like, are you looking at like reducing crime or reducing years in prison?
Yeah. So, I mean, the first thing is that the whole GiveWell Labs approach is going to be different than our traditional work. It's just going to be significantly less quantifiable. It will be like just as critical. Will be just as critical and just as transparent. But we're not going to be able to get to a level of like understanding that I think we were. You know, the types of, so that's just like worth keeping in mind. I think, and just to even go further, I think in a cause like labor mobility, like you may never know whether like you accomplished what you set out to.
Right, yeah. But like you would know if labor mobility improved, right?
So you would. So let's talk, so kind of honing in on criminal justice reform as an example. You know, as we've thought about getting involved here, and we've talked to other organizations about the efforts that they've had, you know, you can look at things like what has happened to prison populations in the states in which you worked, and what has happened to crime rates in the states in which you worked. Like, a problem is you're just dealing with a very small sample, and there's a lot of factors that are not being driven by the philanthropy itself. So, you know, I think that there's been this big criminal justice initiative over the last few years, and what you see is prison populations decline. Crime hasn't risen. Okay, that's all great. If you look at the, if you look at the states in which they worked versus the states in which they didn't work, and you just do that type of simple comparison, you see no impact. But then, like, there's the problem that they chose to work in the states that were least likely to have these changes without them. And so they didn't work in states like New York and California. Well, like, New York and California are unique in many ways, like, not just the fact that this organization didn't work in New York and California. They're, like, more left-leaning states. They have, you know, they're just unique examples. And so we've gone through this whole type of analysis, and I think it, like, will feed into our work. And so in some ways, we'll maintain this, like, quantify what can be quantified, try to come up with the metrics that are most useful. But I think there'll be, you know, we've written a lot about how even in global health metrics are somewhat problematic. You know, I think here they'll be even more difficult. You know, I think the way that we'll end up assessing this type of activity is similar. The best example of it is the work we've done on the history of philanthropy so far. So we have this, like, history of philanthropy project. We're working with, we've worked mostly with one guy over the last year, but, you know, now trying to bring on more people to help with this work. And they're doing more journalistic, qualitative assessments of philanthropic success stories. And so, you know, what he did was one program funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Pew Charitable Trust focus on homelessness, and talk to, like, everyone who was involved in on the legislative side, on the philanthropic side, and trying to understand to the extent to which philanthropy played a role. And I think that is the type of assessment, you know, you could imagine seeing for an area like this.
So you mentioned, like, a couple of areas of policy reform that seemed, like, really, like, important but, like, politically intractable. Like, I think labor mobility was the big one. Are you considering looking into non-policy solutions to any of those problems? Like, it's possible that there's some sort of, like, I don't know, to pick a really terrible idea, but, like, the kind of thing that might be interesting, like, somehow, like, you know, encouraging people to, like, marry people from, like, low-income countries in order to, like, let them, like, come into the U.S. Like, this is sort of, like, an extra policy, like, a non-policy solution to labor mobility. Are you looking into, like, anything in that area?
Yeah,
I mean, I doubt that's, like, actually, like,
I feel like I've seen that somewhere. Like, someone mentioned that on, like, Open Borders blog or some. I don't know if you guys know. Anyhow, there are a group of people who are interested in this. I mean, we would be. I think the like bottom line, right, is that, like, any of the ways that you could you know, meaningfully you could have an impact on, like, the number of people who migrate would be, I think, good, other things equal. Like, obviously something like encouraging people to marry people from other countries, like, has other types of problems. Like, you don't want to create a society of, like, really unhappy marriages. Not that they necessarily would be, but you'd certainly want to be cautious about it.
Sure.
I do think from a, like, you know, our research perspective, like, we would tend to separate those into different buckets. So, I mean, the most obvious case here where I think there's, like, something people talk about is adoption, where, you know, if you are a U.S., you know, someone who lives in the U.S. and you adopt a child from sub-Saharan Africa, you've had this impact on moving someone from that country, to a poor country, to a rich country. And this is, but, like, we sort of have segmented that out as, like, a separate issue to look into. And, like,
are you looking into those?
So, like, adoption specifically is one that's just, like, a little bit lower down on the list. I think the last time we looked, it seemed like the, so this again is, like, just very off the cuff, and I might be wrong about this. Like, it's definitely, like, something we will, like, look into at some point, or I hope we do. Like, just the numbers of people you could, like, realistically imagine, moving are low enough that I'm not sure it would, like, make sense as a cause. Certainly a cause that would get, like, a lot of money. It's certainly possible that it's, like, a decent, like, smaller scale cause if you could, like, find the right way to do it.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think the idea here is, like, the idea behind policy as an area of focus is that you're a very small player influencing a much, like, larger pool of money. This is the reason philanthropy, like, focuses often on policy advocacy. And so I think, like, if you can have some impact on immigration law, you have potentially this very big impact. And so we would consider, like, all of these different ideas, but you'd want to consider them each on their merits. And I'm not sure that, like, you know, and I think they almost end up in their own, like, little cause area.
Okay, so basically, like, the heuristic that led you to consider policy reform is not a heuristic that would have led you to consider, like, non-policy like solutions to the same problems because it's not the actual like end goals of policy reform that the heuristic is about. It's about like the methods of like getting a lot of leverage.
I think you just want to look at each, you can look at each cause and say like, how does it perform on our criteria?
Sure.
And I think the question with like something like marriage or adoption is importance in a sense. Like, is this going to be high impact enough that it's worth putting a lot of money or effort into it? I'm not totally sure. I think it's possible that adoption is, and I'm just not sure whether or not, but it seems like meaningfully different enough that it can be separated from like trying to work on U.S. immigration law from, I don't even know, like whether it's a policy or other issue that would drive adoption.
Cool, thanks.
Did you guys consider looking at like farm subsidies in the U.S.?
Yeah, so farm subsidies are kind of this like known international development issue. For people who aren't familiar, like, a lot of what happens with U.S. food aid is that we buy food produced by U.S. farmers and then ship it overseas. And so this is both kind of inefficient, but also problematic because it reduces the ability of farmers in Africa to earn a living. And this is like a function of, I think, like the farm industry that lobbies Congress and forces the U.S. government to have this restriction. So this is something we looked at. I think we've talked to someone about this, and I can't remember the whether or not those notes are like public or not. They may not be, but basically, this is a case where there's a big, strong lobby on the other side, and I think this like is an issue that a lot of people have worked on. I know that like CARE, the NGO, has been behind this for a long time. I think the sort of people involved in, well, said differently, like there is a, we've looked into like foreign aid generally, and there's a shallow page up on it on our website, which is improving or increasing the U.S. allocation of foreign aid, and there's roughly speaking $100 million that goes into this effort from various organizations like lobbying or advising the government, and so I think there's like a reasonable question whether the marginal increase in this activity, lobbying about foreign aid, will make a difference because you already have like a significant amount of funding there. I think in the case of farm subsidies specifically, people have tried and have failed. That said, I think there is potentially like an angle to this that is like different and interesting. And that is, sort of like farming or industrialized agriculture in general and like what it, you know, the impacts that it has. And so one impact, I think, is like farm subsidies. Like my impression is it's like the same lobby on the other side that's fighting for farm subsidies that is undertaking the sort of the parts of factory farming that are problematic for animals, that are potentially problematic for like antibiotic resistance, that are potentially problematic for the environment. And it seems like there's relatively little funding in the part of this cause that is like, farmers aren't just these like great people who like are kind of living on the land and growing food. It's like large corporations that whose activities are causing some harm. And so I think that it is like possible that that is an area of focus. And the main avenue that we've taken into that idea is via like factory farming from an animal welfare perspective. And that's a cause where we were surprised to find relatively little philanthropic funding compared to what we expected. We had kind of gone in expecting to see like the major animal rights groups like PETA or the Humane Society putting a lot of effort into reforming industrialized agriculture or factory farming. And like it seemed like there was less than $10 million in that cause as a whole.
How big are the organizations for comparison?
How big are the...
Like the big ones that you said you expected to be there?
Oh, I mean, their budgets are like, I think, over like tens of millions to $100 million. Like, I think they focus a lot on like pets, you know, like cats and dogs and like, Yeah,
interesting.
We published a page on factory farming and like the crowdedness of that area. It's actually something we keep looking into because I don't feel like we're totally sure of what we found. We did the shallow investigation, which is like 3 phone calls and write a page. And so now we're trying to do a semi-shallow, semi-deep, medium investigation. The thing with farm subsidies is like this, one of the challenges is always to say, how big is the issue? how tractable is it? And that's one that strikes us as like less tractable from a direct and more crowded from a direct foreign aid perspective. But maybe there's this like farming perspective that is less crowded and also has the potential for other positive impacts.
Infrastructure subsidies in the third world, is that something you've looked at?
Yeah, that's something we have a page on that one too. So that's so infrastructure would be like things like building roads or providing electricity, water, like direct into people's homes, or like ports and airports. This gets a lot of funding from the World Bank and the African Development Bank. It gets almost no, if at any, philanthropic funding. And so that, I think, is like an interest. I mean, there's some like, you know, Google, I know, provides, is like working on internet access in Africa. And so like there are ways in which there's private money going into this. But it's definitely an area that we've categorized infrastructure as part of our foreign aid silo. And foreign aid is something that we just, you know, have not made as much progress on like knowing how we want to proceed as we have with policy. And I'm happy to sort of give my thoughts on why that is. But, you know, in the short stories, I think infrastructure remains an area that we have looked into. You could read like what we've done on it. It's unclear to us like what exactly we would do, but because there's so little philanthropy there, it seems like it's possibly a reasonable area of focus. The things that people told us were like possible, you know, possible sort of misses right now with the current funding infrastructure are things like very early stage project planning for like new like power plants or, you know, or something where like you hope what you would eventually want to see is like the private sector come in and fund this. Like this is just like building a power plant in Kenya or something. And but there, people are risk averse, and it's hard enough to work in Africa that may not be happening. And so philanthropy may be able to fill that gap. I think it's also possible that there's like an advocacy gap where, you know, there's one example, and this is in some conversation notes we published last year, where you basically had U.S. government regulations that were preventing U.S. government funding supporting a new power plant in Africa because it was, you know, producing too much carbon. And so you had this like environmental position was sort of winning out over the like poor African interest. And this is interesting because there's a much stronger environmental lobby than there is a like poor African lobby. And so there's something that you may have seen people talk about now called energy poverty, which is the idea that people without electricity, you know, are in poverty as measured by their lack of electricity. And so I think there's also a possibility of just, you know, you could imagine like that message creating like a humanitarian interest in easing some restrictions on government funding for infrastructure.
So you guys do a lot of work to assess how much funding is like already going into a group. Like, how far do you think we are from having like the Yahoo Finance of like philanthropy? You know, like, you know, some news comes, you're on some nonprofit's website, they've got some news that comes, you know, I mean, with small companies, you're like, oh, this company just rolled out a new product.
Yeah.
It's great to me. My personal insight into this industry tells me that this company is underpriced, like their stock price should have moved, I'm going to invest. Like, wouldn't it be great to like parallel process a ton of really hard thinking about where money ought to go?
Yeah.
But like, then there need to be people like you who are like, you know, making, you know, or do there. Like, is there a way to just have a centralized like Yahoo philanthropy? And then you can just see like, you know, how far are we from that?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that the situation is that like things like economics, politics, finance gets like kind of like poured over in the news, and people are like talking about it, thinking about it, and the same is not true of philanthropy.
Yeah,
and I think a world where like people are doing that is really great. And this is something we talk about, this history of philanthropy project. Like, it's also kind of part and parcel. We'd like to see more like high quality journalism on philanthropy, which is my instinct that like the place to start is high quality investigative journalism or analysis, rather than like trying to build like the database tool, which is something people have also worked on, but I think not particularly successfully. And I could tell you like all the, I don't know what we know about that. But this is something that, so we're very interested in this idea of just like better journalism on philanthropy. We actually, there's a guy who, a journalist who like emailed us out of the blue, who lives in Kenya, who wanted to like do this for us. And so he's actually going to visit one of the first villages that got grants from GiveDirectly like a few years ago. And he's gonna like live in the village for a week and just like write more of a like qualitative piece on what he found. This is not like assessing impacts by any means, right? Like I think the RCT does that well, but it's like trying to poke around and just be more thoughtful, right, about this in a way that is on the ground, independent from GiveDirectly. We're paying him, so you could question how independent he is from us, but we want him to like be independent and just like see what he can do. And this is something that I think could be like potentially a really big deal. And so like if we found people who were like really interested in doing this in basically whatever form, we'd be pretty excited to support it. And so by whatever form, I mean like the model we're doing now is someone is living in Kenya and can like go out to like rural Kenya and live in a village and write about it. But I could imagine someone doing like more of the, I don't know, like Matt Iglesias blogging thing where you like look at the grants that are coming out and you think about them and write about them. And I think that would be great too.
Thought about just like showing up at the Berklee School of Journalism and being like,
So this is, you know, part of like GiveWell's experience, and I really don't know how unique this is compared to other organizations, but we have never been able to like easily build capacity in that way. We wrote a blog post a while ago, like why we can't simply buy capacity, and it was all about our struggles to like easily hire people to do things. So this journalist who's working for us now, hopefully this will work out, right? We haven't actually got any production from it yet, but hopefully in the next month we will. Last year, like I talked, you know, we kind of reached out to a few like real young bloggers, like kids who are like juniors, sophomores, juniors in college. We talked to some people living on the ground. We like went through our network of journalists, and like even I think we came out with three or four people who said they would do things, none of whom actually did anything. And like other people who weren't like kind of pitching ideas to us, like in a way that we were like ready to move forward. So the thing I would say is if someone came to me and was like, I want to produce something, like, I don't know, if they wanted a small amount of money for it, like, we would probably just do it. It would make even more sense for them to just, like, go write something, and, like, then we'd be, like, excited about it and would link to it if it were good. And that's an approach that has worked.
What about a prize?
So this is something where, there's obviously, like, lots of ways to sort of generate interest in this idea. Based on like what really matters is that this is like high quality analysis. And I think that is what is most challenging. I think it's easy to get people to like write about philanthropy. And so what I hope happens is that we slowly like find a few people who do this. Like if you know people who you think would want to do this, let them know. Like, I'm serious. Like we're excited about trying to do this in some way. But like hopefully we'll get some examples and then we'll have things to point to and then we'll say like, hey, this is what we want to see more of. And that's some of what's happened with the History of Philanthropy Project. I went through a long process, talked to a lot of people and found this one guy, Benjamin Soskis, who's been working with us. Now he's worked with us for a year. He's completed one case study. He's working on a second. And now we have two other people where we can just point them to the things that, you know, we've already produced and say, hey, like, we need more like this. Can you do that? And I think that's a much more realistic approach to take. Hey, are we, I think we might be out of time.
No. Did you reserve this room?
There's supposed to be a meeting at 10 p.m.
This is a meeting? We did this one.
Aw, in the other room wrong. Sorry.
That's okay.
I was, like, being meeting.
Okay.
Oh, no, no, this is not your...
Okay.
I'm not sure that it's not this one.
Are you looking for GiveWell, or does that not sound?
No, it's for an event we're doing called Pursuing Your Passion.
Okay. All right, well, if this ends up being the room, we can leave.
Yeah, no worries. I'll let you know.
Okay, thanks.
Sounds compatible.
Cool.
What?
Do you have a question?
GiveWell's all about Pursuing Your Passions.
Yeah, no, we do not do that. No. Strategic cost selection.
So the Y Combinator Venture Capital Group has funded a few, I guess they're calling them nonprofit startups recently.
Yeah.
There's one called WOTC, which does direct health interventions. You can see someone who needs a medical intervention, fund them directly. And there's one called Zadisha, which is doing microfinance with less of a local group involved. I have two questions. I'm curious what you think about those companies in specific and the idea of venture capital backed philanthropy in general. And also, it's really interesting to me that both of these groups have the idea of you see an individual in need of help and you donate to them directly or loan to them. In the case of Tunisia, I suspect that has a much higher conversion rate than things like the Eye of the Salt. If you showed a million people, WOTC, I suspect many more would donate and would those salt. Do you ever consider things like conversion rate in deciding who to recommend? Like a organization with less impact might have a might produce more impact overall as you get more people to put eyeballs in front of them.
Yeah, good question. So you know, I don't know Zadisha. I know of Watsi. You know, I think that, you know, to me, Watsi doesn't seem particularly innovative. It's like very similar to a lot of groups that have come before, which is put a picture of someone up, but the money ultimately flows to a nonprofit that does what the nonprofit was likely going to do otherwise. Or if it doesn't, you've just restricted that nonprofit. The person who chose who to give to has restricted that nonprofit in a way that doesn't seem very logical. It would make more sense for the nonprofit, who knows more about it than the person who's donating, to make that decision. So I think, I mean, venture capital-backed philanthropy could be great. It seems in practice, at least this group that Y Combinator got very excited about, I mean, it just doesn't seem like it's innovative in a way that matters for philanthropic impact. Though, you know, I think you're also right that, like, it has higher conversions. That's why groups like Donors Choose and Kiva and I guess Global Giving that take this model are successful in fundraising. You know, this is not something we consider because we see it as really more of like we want to find the places of highest impact, and then it's like largely someone else's job to think about how to market that in the best way possible. I mean, we want to do a better job communicating about our research and like why what we do is important. I could imagine at some point like practicing the dark arts of fundraising, but it's kind of hard to believe that that is our comparative advantage relative to the other groups that are out there. And so we're pretty excited. We actually were talking to Gain about saltitization, and they were like, wow, this is like a really unsexy cause. How are you going to get your donors to be excited about it? And we're like, no. You don't understand our donors. Very different. So anyhow, we feel fortunate that the people who support our charities are like interested in the type of work we do rather than that other work. Though I also wouldn't be, I can imagine like Give Directly has an opportunity. They take pictures of every house. Like you could see them doing the Kiva thing. And I think if they presented it in like a fully accurate, transparent way, it could be a great way to raise more money.
Can you even go with video?
Yeah, there's a lot of things that, you know, could be done here. That's why it's kind of surprising that Watsi, I mean, I actually know nothing about them other than I feel like they're the same thing as many other organizations that have come before.
Zadisha is the opposite of the problem you have with Watsi. They are taking the local lenders out of the microfinance. So that at least has the potential to be something you might like.
Well, I think there's just this other side of the question is like, do you then want the donor making the decision? Like, are they making, or do you want to have some of the benefit of the sort of local decision about where the money goes? And that, you know, when we wrote a lot about Kiva at the end of 2009, when I guess people discovered that Kiva wasn't what they thought it was, that it was really making a loan to a bank as opposed to giving to an individual. And I think it kind of, like, either way, it's problematic. I mean, just to be clear, like, I don't want to come off as saying, like, Kiva itself is problematic. I just think that the, like, model, the thing that people imagine it to be doing, if it were really doing that, like, seems even worse than, or seems quite problematic. And therefore, like, I think Kiva is making the right decision about how to operate as the most effective Kiva it can be. And then I think, you know, they've certainly made a lot of effort to be more transparent about their approach. But then, you know, I think people should just ask, like, is this the thing that I want to get most excited about, this, like, marketing innovation, as opposed to, like, a sort of a programmatic innovation? All right, I think last question, and then we'll, I know it's late, so
I'll... Okay. I had two questions, so now I have to decide which one I want to
You can ask both. I'll decide which one I want to answer.
Okay. So the first one is, like, what is GiveWell going to do about funding? I have, like, heard a couple things about, like, maybe, like, asking for a tip or, like, something like that. And the second one is, aside from funding and, like, references for capacity, like, what can mere mortals like us do to help GiveWell?
Wow. So I think the best things that you can do to help GiveWell are, you know, engage with our research, think about it critically, and, you know, tell us if you have questions, talk to other people about it. I mean, I think part of the answer to your question from before is, you know, there's like getting people to, like, go out and write about philanthropy, right? Like journalism.
Yeah.
But there's also just like having conversations about like what constitutes effective giving. I suspect you're already doing that. So that may
yeah,
not be a change.
I was more wondering if there's like stuff that you there's, think is like that we're not, we might not already be doing.
No, I mean,
any less likely.
Yeah, I don't think I've great advice other than the things I think you're doing. I mean, obviously supporting our top charities and us to the extent that you're comfortable doing that. You know,
no
I think
more room
you should.
For person hour funds.
Are there more?
There's no more room for person hour funding.
Person hour, yeah. I mean, volunteering or, I mean, look, if you want to work for us, we're hiring, so talk to me. But other than, like, being a full-time staff member, I think it's challenging to support our research efforts directly. And then I'll give a very quick answer on funding us, and if you want more detail, you can talk about it with me after we let people who want to leave. You know, we have grown significantly over the past year, and so, like, we're, you know, our budget has moved up from, like $500,000 at the beginning of last year to like, if we sort of hire at the rate we want to hire, it'll be closer to like $2 million for the 12 months of like 2015, right? So that's like a big increase. And so the question is, where should we get that funding from? You know, we could, I guess, we could go to Good Ventures and say like, we would ask you to give us more funding. That's something that I think they would probably do, but we're not entirely comfortable with because, you know, we don't think it's the right strategic decision to be so beholden to like a single funder. We also think it just like doesn't make us as accountable to the donors who use our research if like a huge proportion of our funding comes from one entity. And so what we've decided to do is like slowly talk to people who about funding us directly and see if they're comfortable doing it. At some point this year, we'll have like an option when you donate to like either give a little more or allocate some funding to GiveWell. So these are things that we're still figuring out. But we've moved from the point in our operations where our sort of funding needs were so small that we could easily raise it from like a very small group of very close people to a point where we sort of need to be more focused on fundraising as an activity. Though we're still in a place where it's kind of a very low priority of ours in the scheme of things. Like it takes up like a couple hours of week a week of mine, and like that's basically the full fundraising operation. So I want to pause because I know it's really late. So I just wanted to thank everyone for coming out late on a certainly what is for me a cold night. I don't know about the Boston area. I guess this is warm. It's like spring here now. But I really and you know being excited to engage with the research we're doing. I mean it's not something we take for granted that donors are happy to like hang out like this with Oreo cookies and apple juice as opposed to like a black tie gala dinner. So that's definitely something we really appreciate. So thank you.
Well, thank you for coming and explaining all this stuff.
Yeah, sure. Cool. So I'm happy to stick around, but you should also feel comfortable leaving.